Well, we may go ahead and get started. My name is Heidi Sorrell, and I see a number of familiar faces, so that's always encouraging, and a number of new faces, that's always nice as well. And for those of you who don't know, I am a professor at Augustana College in the Quad Cities, Illinois, along the Mississippi, northern Illinois, about 2.5 hours west of Chicago. And rumor has it from Jeannie Olson, who's I've known for a very long time, that we had somewhere in the range of 4 to 5 inches of rain last night. And we've been having rain like that for the entire month of June, and apparently it's continued on into July, so I'm sure our Mississippi is quite high. In any case, this week, some of you know, I've been talking about ethics. I started off with a talk about ethical theory, the two kinds of opposing theories that we have in this country. One of these, and we've had this since, about the beginning 1800s, so very, very long time. On the one hand, we have what is known as utilitarianism. It's a very practical, it's a social political theory, but it has an underlying, very strong underlying moral basis, and it is part of our legacy that we share with our British history, with our British ancestors. It is a theory, an approach to ethical decision making that is based in the motto, greatest good for greatest number. So if you think about that motto for just a little while, you can see why that might resonate with things democratic, greatest good for greatest number. That's one tradition. The other tradition has a much longer history, and that tradition is not secular, it is not necessarily problematic, and it's based in this idea of ontos. And this idea of ontos, that's a Greek word, it's the word that means being, with a capital B, that which is greater than all we are. That tradition is one that has both secular and religious versions, but primarily versions that are spiritual in nature. And as I said on my very first day here, which was on Monday, the reason why we can't seem to solve moral dilemmas in this country is because we have those two opposing traditions. Many of our legislators, for example, are trained in utilitarian decision making, but their own personal lives are spiritual lives. And so how do you wrestle with those two inconsistencies when you're trying to decide about the death penalty, about abortion, about the kinds of issues that have been with us for many, many, many years? So that's what I did on my first day. And ever since then, we've gone practical. We've talked about medical ethics. We've talked about organ transplantation in that context. We've talked about social ethics. There are example was punishment, and in particular, capital punishment in light of what happened in Utah a few weeks ago. And then yesterday, I talked about environmental ethics, in part because we are here, but also in part because of what has been happening in the Gulf of Mexico. So what are we going to do today? I'm going to let you exercise your free will. Actually, this is a plug for a talk that I'm going to give next week on the nature of free will. What does it mean to be free? I mean, we have freedoms in this country. It's a defining characteristic, again, of who we are, both politically and spiritually. But what exactly does it mean to be free? All right, so we'll look at that next week, but I'm going to let you exercise whatever it is today and ask you the following question. I couldn't decide what I wanted to do today. I actually had a lecture scheduled for Tuesday, and that got moved to today, and so that kind of changed things just a little bit for me. So I'm going to let you decide what we ought to do today. Here are the two options. We could look at how it is that we got to where we are today. All right? How is it, by looking at the history of ideas that shaped our thinking, both secularly and actually some of the religious thinking that we have. How did we get to the Gulf crisis? How did we get to the death penalty? How did we get to the war in Iraq? If you were here for Peter Thompson's talk yesterday, how in the world did we get to this position of torture? All right, if you were in Norm Moline's class yesterday or the day before, how did we get to our position on watersheds, our position on forestry? All right, so that's one option. Go the history of ideas route. The other option is to delve a bit deeper into ethical theory. And I know that in the past few days, I've characterized the utilitarian position a little bit more strongly than I have characterized the non-utilitarian position. And the reason for that is because it's the utilitarian position, I think, that got us into those dilemmas. So what does the other side say? So we could do ethics. So there are your options. What's your pleasure? How many people for a history, kind of idea, history of ideas view? Pardon?
From what perspective?
From the perspective of, this is how I think we got to where we are today. All right, that's the first option. But it looks like the ethics option wins out. How many people for the ethics option? All right, that's the way we'll go. Okay, well, given that you have chosen the ethics option, which was actually my option number one as well, I'm going to put you to work. All right, I've been doing ethics all week, so now it's time for you to do some ethics. And so what I thought we would begin with is a case study. A very, very famous case study. We'll look at, I think, probably three or four case studies today. And then we'll look at that theory as well. I like to, as many of you know, if you've been in my previous classes, I like to combine facts and theory with stories, right? And case studies are stories. So I hope I have enough for everyone. If I don't, then maybe you can share. I'll give you that. That pile is a little bit smaller. And I'd like you to take a moment and look at this particular story. It's a true story. Some of you might actually even be familiar with this particular case. I know I made about 23 copies, but some of the people that were in my classes over the past few days begged for their own version as homework, and so I'm probably down to about 18 copies, so that's not enough for all of us, but then just share it.
Other view again, deontology.
Anybody need a bit more time to read through it? All right, I've actually found that if I read case studies, the results are sometimes different, at least among my students, than when they read them on their own. That's probably because my intonations highlight unconsciously certain aspects of the case than they do otherwise. So that's why I thought I'd have you read this. Other cases that we look at today, I will certainly speak through. So you have the question there at the bottom. If you had been on the jury, how would you have decided and why? So there you go.
I would have hung the jury. I wouldn't have been able to decide.
Aha. Uh-huh. So what you would have said is you would have refused assignment.
Yeah, I just.
All right.
It's too hard.
Just can't do it. Okay, all right.
Well, first I thought that the rule was the captain went down with the ship.
Mm-hmm.
But the captain was the most valuable person because he would have known the most about how to save the mm-hmm. survivors.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Then I thought, well, maybe he should have asked for volunteers to go overboard.
Okay.
But then if the strong people went overboard, the exactly. weak...
Yeah. Exactly.
The weak-willed, at least, had less chance to survive.
Exactly. So and actually, in their discussions, this came up, that maybe we should ask for volunteers, and exactly that happened. Not all of the strong men on the ship volunteered, but enough of them that would call into question the decision in the first place. All right, some more comments on this. Yes, please.
The captain is God on the ship and is God on the rowboat, and so his will is law.
All right.
Not my point of view, but that's the law.
That's the law.
That is the case. Should it be the case? Or would you defer judgment? Suppose you were that captain, right? How would you make that decision? Yes?
Well, I can think of two situations. How about the idea of triage?
Mm-hmm.
How about the idea of people, at least in the past, when they needed kidney?
Sure.
They had to make a decision which people, I know people who were rather kidney.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Although, again, how would triage work in this case? Who would it favor? They still have a long way to row. There's a storm coming. And if anyone is to survive, it's probably the ones who are not saved are the women and the children, right? The weak who can't row through that storm.
So did seven strong men survive? Just curious.
We'll get to that.
Okay.
We'll get to that. Yes.
Anyway, I don't know if he did the right thing, but I have a reasonable doubt about it, so I'd probably vote to acquit.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. That's a clear-cut answer. Yeah.
I think I would have to declare him guilty, but then make a difference in the punishment phase, which would be no punishment.
Mm-hmm. None whatsoever.
Well,
even though he was directly responsible for, as it turned out, let's see, there were, unclear exactly, but about 10 to 12 survivors. 10 to 12 people did survive out of the 30, all right? So those that didn't make it, those 18 or so, right? He was directly responsible for their deaths.
He was also directly responsible for the
lives of the people
that survived.
Exactly right.
But he wasn't directly responsible for their death. The storm and the shipwreck was responsible for their death.
Well, listen to how this is put. We are told that, let's see, where is it? I thought I had it underlined. If nothing were done and everyone died as a result, no one would be held responsible, right? Natural disaster, mm-hmm. natural cause, let nature take its course. On the other hand, if the captain attempted to save some, he would do so only by killing others, and their deaths would then be his responsibility. If they're not jumping out of the boat, right, volunteering, right, then they have to be, what? Forced out of the boat, okay, tossed over, all right? So in that sense, he is responsible. All right, we had a comment too.
Not enough information on the card.
Yeah, that's true, but that's intentional on my part. What additional information do you want?
How did the boat go down? What was the situation with sinking the ship?
What
was the condition of the lifeboat? What was the condition of all the people on the boat? Were they all crew? Were they passengers?
They were all crew, so it was not a pleasure boat. It was icy cold water because the ship struck the iceberg. The life raft was in fairly good shape, and they had reasonable hope that they would survive.
And failure of navigation for accident, or?
Lifeboat. Did they have enough?
Pardon? No, they did not have enough lifeboats. They could only take, what was it, 7 out of the 30. If we continue to have a margin of safety, right, then we could only take 7. But they actually let that margin of safety go such that they could take 3 or 4 or 5 additional people. Again, I don't remember exactly how many. All right, navigation, well, it's in the mid-1800s, right? So navigation is not what we have today, but the captain was very experienced and had taken this trip many times. So, you know, again, he had some reason to believe that he could at least bring some of his crew back to safety. All right,
was he responsible for the accident?
No, no. We cannot hold him responsible for that particular accident. It's just one of those that happened in the course of his trip. Yes?
So, should there have been more lifeboats?
Probably.
But there was only one.
Yeah, yeah.
It feels damned if you do, damned if you don't.
That's the nature of an ethical dilemma.
Yeah.
Right? That's it. That's exactly an ethical dilemma. I work in a clinical setting, as some of you know, and we've made a distinction between an ethical concern. All right, so somebody has some qualms about the way a patient is being treated, for example. We have an ethical situation where those qualms become more serious. All right, where we actually think, you know, there is reason to believe that there's a dilemma here. And then, in the worst case scenario, we have exactly the situation that you described, where it is a lose-lose situation, but yet you want to make sure that those losses are kept at a minimum. So this is exactly one of those situations. All right, one more comment, and then we're going to move on.
I think I would vote to acquit based on the idea that, you know, it's situational ethics.
Ah.
This is a situation where decisions had to be made based on extraordinary conditions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And what options were there? And
okay.
To me, it was for the best outcome.
Okay. All right. So it's interesting that you use the word situational ethics. Did you use that intentionally? Do you know the history of that term?
Slightly.
It comes from a Catholic theologian by the name of Joseph Fletcher. He's the first one who coined the term situational ethics. And his reasoning is exactly your reasoning, that there really aren't any absolutes, all right, and that what we have to do is a kind of case-by-case-by-case analysis, all right? That has made many people who think about these kinds of issues uncomfortable. It has made them uncomfortable because it comes very, very close to allowing for a kind of relativism. And if we think about the basis of Christian morality, the Ten Commandments, those really aren't situational. Those are not debatable, right? You cannot take the name of the Lord thy God in vain on some occasions and not in other occasions. Fletcher says it's okay. That's where he has made his mark in Catholic theology. But many others will argue that's not the way to go because it is too close to relativism. Right?
What is relativism?
What is relativism? Great question. Here I can give you another example. One of the persons on the ethics committee that I work with, the week before I came up to Holden, so this was the last week in June, is a Catholic priest, an absolutely fantastic Catholic priest. He is one of the best members on our committee. And we were thinking about a patient who was suicidal. And she was convinced that she was terminally ill. She had a number of other situations in her life. She had gathered her family and friends together, had a farewell party, attempted to take her life. It didn't go well. She was being rehabilitated and overheard in the hospital when she was in the rehabilitation phase that as soon as she got out, she was going to take her life again. All right. So medical staff heard this, so they can't release her, right? But she's ready to go. So that was our dilemma. The Catholic priest on our committee, as we were hearing this case, said, well, you know, at some point, we just have to realize that our ethics differ. So her ethics, which is fine for her, differs from our ethics, which is fine for us. That's relativism. That ultimately is the position, who am I to say what you should do? You have to make up your own mind. And to almost to the end, those who think about Christian ethics or religious ethics, if we use a broader term which includes some other religions, will say relativism is not the way to go. All right? That if we have a religious ethics, it cannot be who am I to say what you should do. There are some absolutes. Again, look at the Ten Commandments. All right? So that's what relativism is. All right. So let's look at this case from the utilitarian perspective. What would the utilitarian say?
He did the right thing.
He did the right thing. Absolutely. He made the best out of a terrible situation. He did the greatest good for the greatest number. Okay? Hold that thought, because what we want to ask is what would the other side say? All right, what would the other side be tempted to say? And again, remember, the utilitarian side is our social political theory. It is the morality that underlies our social political theory. So very quickly, since, again, I've given a lot of attention, I think, to utilitarianism this week, let's run through criticisms thereof, and then we can make way for the alternative. So criticisms. Here's one. It is too simplistic. Many of you have heard me say that on the utilitarian point of view, all you have to do is the cost-benefit analysis. It's known as a moral arithmetic. It's known as a hedonic calculus in the literature. And when you run through that cost-benefit analysis, the correct answer will just be spit out. All right? That's criticism number one. Here's another criticism. There's something called the integrity problem. Utilitarianism forces us as individuals, it's an assault actually on our integrity. If you think about the case that I talked about where a person was put in the terrible situation of trying to decide to take one life in order to save 11, right? What a terrible position for a person to be in, to have a moral theory require you to take that life, right? The morally correct thing to do is to take the life of that one person to save the others. There's a problem with that. There's a problem with a moral theory that requires that of us. Here's a third problem. This is one we haven't talked about yet, but we will at several points today. Special responsibilities. All right? We have special responsibilities. If we are in certain professions, then we have special obligations that pertain to us, special duties, special responsibilities. But I would want to suggest that we also say we have special responsibilities to our friends, to our family members, and perhaps to those in our particular communities. Okay, so that it isn't the case that my responsibility to a 20-year-old African just randomly chosen is the same as my responsibility to my 12-year-old daughter. Okay, there's a difference in responsibility there. Not for the utilitarian. For the utilitarian, they have an objective view, they have a universalistic view, and they have a pragmatic view. Universalistic, all count for one, no one counts for more than one. That's what the founder of utilitarianism said. But let me show you just what that means. I mean, it's great to think we're all equal morally, but does that mean we have equal responsibilities to everyone? The deontologists, the other side, say no. All right? So let me give you an example. I could give you two. I'll go with this one. Suppose that Aunt Bess, all right, is a kind of an eccentric relative that you have. All right? She is quite elderly. Let's suppose she's about 98. All right? And she still has full cognitive capacity, although her physical health is deteriorating rather quickly. You've always been her favorite relative. Most of the other family members think she's kind of weird, but you know, she's harmless, she's nice, all right? But she's always favored you. So she gives you a phone call, and you think, well, this is kind of unusual because she never calls anyone, all right? And she says that she needs to meet you. So you go to her house, and she says, well, no one in the family knows this, but I'm actually a millionaire. Okay, I've been squirreling away my money, all right? It's in my mattress, all right? And I've just accumulated all this wealth, and I know that my days are limited, and I need to tell you about this because you're my favorite relative. All right, so you're thinking, odd, she's just gonna give it to me? She has a condition. Her condition is this. She has a cat. Her cat's name is Felix, all right? And Felix has been her closest friend and ally for the past 10 years. So she wants you to make the following deathbed promise. She wants you to give Felix everything that he could possibly need. All right, so Felix has a gold collar. He sees the vet once a week to make sure that he's in optimal condition. He's fed caviar at least once a day. His milk comes from a cow that is milked for that purpose, so it's fresh, all right? And he has the best of life, but it costs thousands of dollars to maintain this. But she had the money. Nobody knew she was feeding this cat. We always thought, you know, the diamonds around the neck were fake, right? But lo and behold, they're real. So she wants you to take care of her cat, Felix. Oh, by the way, this requires 24-hour companionship for the cat, too. So you can't go off to work, right, and then come home and be with the cat. No, this requires more than that, all right? Once the cat is gone, okay, so the cat is 10, all right, it's not going to live forever, maybe 10 years maximum, the rest of the money is yours. All right, so do you make that promise?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
No. Do you have special responsibilities to her?
No. She said give the cat what it needs.
Mm-hmm. Oh, but then she tells you exactly what those needs are.
I'll look for interpretation once she passes.
Ah, that is the billion-dollar question. Well, million-dollar question. So you say, of course, Aunt Bess, I will take care of Felix, just like you said. All right? She dies. All right? And then what do? It's Purina and water the whole way, which is probably healthier for the cat anyway, but we'll let that go. Is that what you do?
Yeah.
But then you've lied.
Once Aunt Beth is dead, she knows the truth anyway and sees the folly of the condition of treating her cat. So, no longer becomes
a cat. Do you all agree with him?
Sounds good.
I'd like to.
Is that the right thing to do? I mean, this is a dying
relatively
person.
Speaking, it is.
Relatively, but we've dismissed relativism.
Why?
Because we don't want to be put in a situation where we are unable to make judgments on other people.
Why do you want to make judgments on other people?
Because I think sometimes it's necessary.
Terrifying.
It is a terrifying responsibility that we have.
Not one I'm going to take.
Ever?
I hope not.
Well, how about the rest of you?
What was the,
so,
I didn't hear what he said.
He's advocating a position of perhaps relativism, maybe for the sake of argument, maybe not. And that would involve that we cannot judge other people. We can't punish other people for the actions that they undertake. Right?
Correct.
Okay.
I quit my job and pay myself to take care of the cat.
You would?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm committing that.
All right. So you would disagree with him?
Yeah.
All right.
I obey her wishes, but I pay myself whatever I
of course.
Fit.
Of
so
course.
To the, what are you going to feed
right.
The cat? Whatever she says.
The caviar and the fresh milk.
Until the money runs out, then I go back to work.
The money won't run out.
Oh, okay. Well, then, yeah.
Okay.
No, I can do whatever I want. I can hire a cat sitter.
But then
I have enough money to do that, too.
Okay.
Would you pay yourself and take care of the cat, and then could you, with your salary, could you decide that you wanted to donate to worthy causes?
I
could
do whatever
salary?
I want. Yeah.
Okay. Better than that little shelter.
I could pay
right.
myself $1 million a year.
Right. So it is true that, I mean, if we were to say, sure, I'm going to make that promise to Aunt Bess, all right? I don't have special obligations to her, right? I can lie to her on her deathbed. As soon as she's dead, I can do what I want. But that doesn't mean that what you have to do is selfish, right? That could mean that you donate to animal shelters, that you do research in feline leukemia, that you feed the poor with her millions. But you've still lied to her. And the question is that wrong? The utilitarians, again, think about how simple their solution is. You fool, go ahead and break that promise. It would be immoral if you didn't do that. All right? But the utilitarians are nervous because then it means, sorry, the deontologists are nervous because then it means lying is okay sometimes, but it's not okay other times. So there's nothing intrinsically wrong with lying. It just depends on the circumstances, which gets us into that situational ethics, which gets us into that relativism, which makes people nervous. Okay, saw your hand first.
I don't think I could do it, and I couldn't lie, so I'd have to tell her I couldn't do it.
Right. Okay, so, and you, that's fair. So, great. The deontologist would say exactly the thing to do. Yes?
Well, your special responsibility is to Felix the cat.
Mm-hmm. Well, after the fact it is.
She wants the very best for the cat, and what she's prescribed for the cat is not good for the cat.
Yeah, that's
and
true.
You know this.
That's
and
true.
And so you have to provide the best for the cat, which is also taking the cat to work and giving him a wider world to live. besides healthy food.
Yes. And this, of course, assumes that you're not allergic to the cat, so that you don't have additional burdens there.
I am allergic.
So, you know, you're absolutely right. It is indeed the case that at some point the special responsibilities are transferred to the cat, but the primary responsibilities are still to Aunt Bess. I mean, that's the person involved in the promise making, right? The cat isn't capable of being the recipient of a promise. It's Aunt Bess that you're making that promise to. We're going to be talking about, plug for next week, the nature of persons as well. So not only free will, but the nature of persons. One more comment. Yes?
It seems like we ought to have some conversation about relationships here. And, you know, the woman isn't God yet.
Yeah.
And sure, you're her favorite whatever. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of worried you are, Roger. Is it, okay, can we talk to me about what is it you really want for your cat? Why do you need to do the things you've done? And what is it you hope I will do for the cat?
Right.
It seems like we ought to have a conversation about some of what's in the best interest. And we're just talking about the particulars here, but not about talking together about what she has in
mind. But she is stubborn and she is eccentric.
Well, that's true. But, you know,
so it's a possibility.
Eccentric people have interesting conversations, but at least you can give it a word.
True. And I think that's part of what comes out of your position, right? You're going to be straight up with her and then see what response she makes. I can't resist. I have to give you my other example. This one is haunting. Right? This one is haunting. My dissertation advisor was a utilitarian, apparently one of the nation's best utilitarians. And I actually intentionally chose to study with him so that I could understand exactly what I, given my beliefs, was up against, you know, what the strongest challenge would be. And so he talked about this special responsibilities challenge in the following way. He said, this is a dreadful example. He said, suppose that you have a street on an incline, all right? Suppose that you and your child and the parent with their child are driving in opposite directions and there's an accident, all right? And suppose that both of those children don't have their seatbelts on, the windows are open, it's a summery day, and for some strange reason they're thrown out of the car. And they're both in need of desperate medical attention. Both of the parents are okay, by the way. So you look at the other child, you look at your child, and you immediately, you know, go to your child. And you're asked, well, why did you save your child? And the response that the utilitarian makes is, because my child was closest to me, and I knew I could give it the medical attention first. And so in a triage sort of way, I knew I had a greater chance of saving the child that was closest to me than the one that was further away. So the fact that it was your daughter plays no role, right? This is the universalistic element of utilitarianism. Everyone counts for one, no one counts for more than one. So if the other child would have been closer, he would have gone to the other child.
Is he a doctor?
He is a PhD doctor. He's not a medical doctor.
Not a medic.
No.
How about the other parent?
No, neither of them are. But they know enough to put a tourniquet on if there's severe bleeding. So
the other parent could go to his child.
Presumably, yeah.
So you might say, well, I know that other kid's gonna be taken care of by his parents. So
but you don't know that. You don't know that.
No,
all you know is there are two children
that.
In need, and you go to the one that's closest, and it happens to be your own. How fortunate for you. But isn't that a chilling theory?
Yes.
That is a chilling theory. But yet that's the theory that underlies, again, our social political structure. All right, one more problem, then we're going to move on to the alternative, or an alternative. Last problem, I like this word. If you ever play Scrabble, and you have the opportunity to use this word, isn't that cool? It is the incommensurability problem. And we talked about this yesterday. Yesterday when we were talking about environmental ethics and the dominion over the earth view of environmental ethics, it's also the anthropocentric view as we called it, one of their claims was, well, what's it worth to you? Okay, what's clean water worth to you? What are you willing to give up for it? Are you willing to give up your golf game? All right, because that's a major pollution for water, small stream water. So the incommensurability problem says you can't answer that question sometimes. You can't ask or answer that question, what is it worth to you? There are incommensurate values. So Sophie's Choice, anybody familiar with that?
Yeah.
There you have a case of incommensurability. How do you choose between your two children? Or the impossible situation I put my father in, if you read my little description up there on the kiosk, where I was young, I didn't know anything about ethics per se, right? And I asked him, well, if you could save, I remember this, I was in bed, he was putting me to bed, and I remember looking at him, he was up here, he was on my left side, and I said to him, if you could save only my mother or me, which would you save? Who would you save?
Oh,
you know, those are incommensurability issues. Not for the utilitarian. Throw in that cost-benefit analysis, that hedonic calculus, and the answer will spit out. All right? But that question, that incommensurability, how do you put a price on it? Right? The whole commodification of life. This came up in when we were talking about organ transplantation. There's a theory out there. It's actually catching on, you know, it's actually close to policy at this point. Not yet official, but it's being pushed. Where if, for example, a heart transplant costs about $300,000, okay, just for the act, not for the follow-up care, mm-hmm. then the person who, or better put, the family of the person who donates the heart should be paid 10% of the total cost of that operation. All right? So we're putting a value on body parts. All right? That kind of commodification is something that the utilitarians have absolutely no problem with. All right? The deontologists say there's got to be a better way to go. So let's turn to deontology. Here are the historic criticisms of deontology. Let me put that word up here again because I like that word. Deontology has a Greek history to it, such that deon, D-E-O-N, means absolutely binding. Kind of like the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments is on that side of the divide. Okay, absolutely binding. All right. The other part that I like about this word deontology is the onto, which actually from the Greek comes ontos, and that is the idea of being. Okay, not human being, although being is a part of this larger being. All right. Maybe some would call it the supremely perfect being. So automatically, just by looking at that word, you can see how it's going to have a different approach to the shipwreck case, to the special responsibilities case, to the making the promise to Aunt Bess case. All right, so I want to dig a little bit deeper into this. Let me see. Where shall we start? I'll skip that. We'll go jump right into it. For deontology, there are a couple of key ideas, all right? And it doesn't matter here if you have a Christian ethic, or if you are Hindu or Buddhist, or if you are actually Muslim, or if you are some secular version of a deontologist. These various points that I'm going to go through are common to all. And then the differences in those various groups come out in the details. So for the deontologists, this is one of their big claims, there is hope that we can at least reach some sort of agreement about things like slavery, which, lo and behold, we have, haven't we? Right? We no longer endorse slavery. Maybe the same kind of moral sense that developed about slavery can be developed in terms of torture, if you were there last night, or forest management, if you were at the session yesterday afternoon, or dreadful things like abortion, or euthanasia, or the death penalty. All right? So at least these people still have hope. These people have nothing that is intrinsically valuable. Again, that's one of their tenets. There is nothing, that's their relativistic stand, that there's nothing that is absolutely right or wrong. All right? So what are these tenets? Here's one. They advocate, they advocate the notion of a moral intuition. All right? They advocate the idea of a moral intuition. Some people call it the goodwill. Some people call it conscience. Most of the deontologists will say part of your human nature is that you have this. Okay? You have an inner voice. All right? You have something inherently what is right and wrong. And they have very graphic examples where almost every single time people will say, yeah, that is absolutely right, or that is absolutely wrong. And I hesitate to use those examples because they are very graphic. If you want one, ask me afterwards, all right? The idea here, though, is this conscience, this goodwill, all right, that never makes mistakes with respect to morality, all right, is something we don't pay attention to. Given our society, given the, as I used the term yesterday, given the mask of inauthenticity, you know, we know that voice is back there, but we rationalize it away, or we shut it down, or we don't communicate, right, with our fellows in such a way that that voice could actually play a role in our decision making, all right? But that's one of the fundamental beliefs of the deontologists, that you have that capacity to make the right decision. You have the capacity to make the right decision. All right, second tenet.
And that there is a right decision.
Right, and that is this Dion idea that there is something that is absolutely binding. And again, our example here that we can use in our context is are the Ten Commandments. Those are not subject to debate, right? They're not subject to debate. Now, of course, there are interpretational issues, and we can say, well, once we get the interpretation down, right, once we read the original text, then, and they are fairly simplistic, they have to be if they are to be of any use to us, right? But at some core level, they are absolutely binding. All right. And we have the capacity to follow, to be good. Our problem is we aren't, right? Because of the rationalizations and various other things that get into our way. Okay, second tenet. This is an interesting one, too. Lots of ways of putting this. We have free choice. We have free will. The more political word for this is we have autonomy, right? Patient self-determination is big in the hospital context, all right, legal autonomy. The most traditional word here is free will. It buys into the idea that we have the will and we have the understanding, all right? And those two together will keep us from sinning. All right, if those are used in the correct sort of balance. That's the traditional story. Comes out of St. Anselm, St. Augustine, St. Aquinas. They all talk in that terminology. The point is, however, that for the deontologist, they believe we have this. This is very, very, very important because think of the way of the sequence here. We have free will, all right? It's that free will which allows us to be morally responsible, so I'll just put moral responsible, all right? And that moral responsibility allows us to be blamed or to be praised. So there's a kind of causal sequence that occurs here, and it all starts with free will, right? If that's why we hold, why we don't hold, sorry, somebody who is insane legally responsible. That's why we don't hold those who are mentally handicapped responsible. That's why we don't hold small children responsible. Because they don't yet have that fully developed sense of freedom. All right? But once we have it as adults, we are morally responsible. All right? And these adjectives can be described. Right? They can be assigned to us.
Isn't that debatable? Because what?
Well, no. Go.
I'm just wondering, isn't that debatable?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It is. Two points to note. One is, that's why we're going to talk about this next week. All right? This right here, we should be loath to give up. Because if we give that up, then how do we hold each other responsible? And maybe that's where you're coming from in terms of blaming and non-blaming. But if we give up the ability to hold each other accountable because we're not free in the first place. Wow. You know, how, for Anselm, Aquinas, and Augustine, how does that play out with respect to the notion of sinful acts? If you're secular, how does that play out with respect to legal responsibilities? Right? So it is debated. It is hotly debated. I have a terrific, complicated, next week, on this notion of freedom and whether or not we have it. All right, but the idea is, if we give that up, we're giving up a lot. And the utilitarians, you might be thinking, well, where do the utilitarians stand on this? They don't care. They're willing to give it up. Okay, they don't have any problems with this. As a matter of fact, the deontologists will say against the utilitarians that they are way too animalistic. All right, they're way too animalistic. What drives, and I think they're right about this, what drives their calculus is pleasure, the avoidance of pain, and self-interest. And all of that is based in biology. Right? That's all based in biology. So they say, you know, these arguments that you give against freedom, great. That shows us that our view is more plausible than your view. All right? But I'm not sure they'll have the last word on that. We'll see.
The instincts you just talked about are instincts that animals have.
Mm-hmm.
And supposedly we have...
Right.
Human, whatever.
Right. That's why we're going to talk about our personhood next week as well, because as it turns out, for the utilitarians, they tend to be, here's what they're called, they tend to be advocates of materialism, which means that I don't know of a single utilitarian who doesn't believe, I got to make sure I get this right, no utilitarian that I know believes in an immaterial mind or spirit. All right, so they are materialists all the way down. I mean, how in the world would you introduce those kinds of considerations into your calculus? Right? How, that's the incommensurability problem. How do you weigh the value of a spirit against the value of a body? Right? It comes up in medicine all the time, by the way. Right? That's why they talk about the whole self in medicine, but how well do we treat the whole self in medicine? Right? It's all about the body, or at least a lot of it is, though I'm hoping we're moving away from that. Maybe slowly we are. But you are exactly right. Here, they don't have to worry about freedom. But over here, the notion of a person is, here's the alternative view, dualistic. It's dualistic. You have a material side, of course, all right, flesh and blood, but you also have an immaterial side. Right? And that immaterial side usually involves a mind, a rational capacity, cogitans is what it's called in the Latin traditional terminology. But you also have what else?
A spirit.
Right, you have a spirit. All right. Okay, so freedom, dualism, moral intuition are all a part of this view. One thing that we haven't yet talked about on this view, and it's a major part, is that notion of the absolutely binding duty. The absolutely binding duty. All right? As it turns out, this up here, these three parts, they compose what is called, they compose the theory of value. This down here composes what is called the theory of obligation. This tells us what we value intrinsically, what is good in and of itself, or what we value instrumentally. I mean, those are important too. We'll see that in a second. This tells us what we ought to do, how we ought to act. All right? The idea is we all, in our moral thinking, have both of these. We have values and we have obligations. And the values are what inform our actions. All right? Now, the deontologists are very, very detailed and meticulous about this. The utilitarians are really simple, right? Their values are, again, pleasure, the avoidance of pain, self-interest. All right? Those values inform what they do. Not so easy. Look at these values in comparison to that. How do those values inform our duties, our absolutely binding duties? Okay, that's what we got to take a look at next. Please.
I'm just curious because the utilitarians seem all black and white, deontology seems a million shades of gray.
Mm-hmm.
Is there nothing blending between the two?
No.
I find that hard to believe.
They all seem all black and white.
Yeah. Well, that's a very good point. Let me just say this. They, the utilitarians, say simplicity is their virtue. They say complex and it's a mess. It's a mess. Because you cannot combine a relativistic point of view, right, with an absolutely binding point of view. How do you do that? It's like mixing, you know, two substances that can't be mixed, oil and vinegar. How do you get that into a single solution? You can't.
Yes, you can.
Yeah. Well,
you make a vinaigrette.
Yeah, but if you look at the vinaigrette, what happens? It dissolves, right? It separates out.
So there's no continuum here between utilitarian and the deontology?
Not really.
I think you just said there isn't.
No, there isn't.
The cool thing about God is he doesn't follow our rules.
That's right. That's absolutely right. But he gives us guidance in terms of what we ought to do. That's that being notion, right? These people over here, and I guess, well, that must be the correct time, right? Okay, good. These people over here view human being, that's us, encircled by being, by ontos, all right? So where Dostoevsky is a good person to keep in mind in connection with what we're talking about right now. Dostoevsky said, if God is dead, then anything is possible. All right? So if we don't have that, right, that on the deontological point of view, if God is dead, if we don't have that being which surrounds us, then anything goes. Then utilitarians are great. All right, but I see some hands. We'll go with you first.
Quick question. If free will is under the deontologist's side, why isn't determinism a criticism of...
It is. I just skipped it.
You just skipped it.
Yeah, okay. I didn't want to put another big word up there. Okay. Well, I wanted to try to keep it a little bit simple.
I was just making sure that...
But you're absolutely right. Yep. For sake of completeness,
okay.
More on this next week, determinism. And if you're familiar with determinism, it's actually a hard determinism, fits on that side. That's the complete and total denial of all free will. That is B.F. Skinner and the rats in the maze. He, B.F. Skinner, just one last point on this right here, he's the one who actually wrote the book, what? Beyond Freedom and
Responsibility.
Dignity. Beyond Freedom and Dignity. So there you have it. Beyond Freedom, Determinism, and Dignity. There goes your integrity. All right, so thank you for noting that incompleteness. Yes?
I think vinaigrette is actually a good metaphor for most of us human beings. I think we are a mixture of these things. That then when you start probing on arguments, all of our arguments, or many of our arguments, then start running into trouble from one side or the other.
You're right. And I think one of the things, I mean, I would like to believe that we want to be, I don't know if I want to put it this way, we want to be the best that we can be, right? We want to be the best moral persons that we want to be. So that if we come up with a decision between, you know, what's the right thing to do and the wrong thing to do, we want to do the right thing, all right? And then that raises the question on this spectrum, or lack thereof, where we want to spend most of our time. Do we want to spend it over here, or do we want to spend it over there? I mean, we make mistakes. We do sin, right? So we're not just going to be on that side. We're not this kind of being or that kind of being, right? So you're right. We are sort of like vinaigrette. But the question is, you know, how much oil do we want to be as opposed to how much vinegar?
That's right.
Yeah. You had your hand up. You're going to let it go? Okay.
Doesn't that leave you in situational ethics? Because sometimes... Mm-hmm. You wanted the real picture is clear in your head, and you want to be a deontologist. And the other time, it's silly to spend $1 million on a cat.
Yeah,
in my view.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to make choices on both sides depending on the situation.
But you know what the deontologist would say about the cat example? Exactly what you said. Honestly, tell Aunt Bess I can't do it. It's not that you have to make that promise to her. It's rather that you just have to be honest with her. And that's hard. That's really, really hard. But they're the first to say, you know, doing the ethically right thing is a hard thing to do.
Well.
Yes.
Well, I was going to just say that it also means giving up something that's going to benefit me.
Oh, yeah.
I want that money.
Right.
But that's our material.
Right. Absolutely right.
Just quickly, in the very beginning of your presentation, did you say that, for example,
politicians or governments are trained up in the utilitarian way of
our government.
Our government.
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. If you look at our historical documents, beginning with the Constitution, all the way through the Bill of Rights, and if you look at current policy making, again, if you look at some of the torture documents, the twist on that is never deontological in nature.
Is what?
Never deontological never. In nature. Yeah.
Yeah. I know you're about out of time, but what are the criticisms of deontology?
There aren't any.
There aren't
any. All right, so what are the criticisms? We should talk a little bit about duty as well. Let me just give you very quickly.
Well, the criticism would be that you'd have no survivors from the
from that boat. That may be correct. That
no,
may be
no,
correct.
No, the captain's doing his duty.
Right. Well, it depends on how seriously we interpret the special responsibility that the captain may have taken on as captain. All right. So that would be one thing to take a look at. But if there were no special responsibilities, suppose it was, you know, just somebody who was in charge of the ship, but for some reason without, you know, legally being in charge of the ship, all right? If that's the case, the deontologist would say, well, you know, should he be playing God? Should he be making those life-death decisions? And maybe the thing to do is to let nature take its course there.
In which case, the criticism would be,
right,
no one survived.
Right. In which case, the criticism is that these deontological views, like the Ten Commandments, are too rigid. Okay? They're too hard for us to follow. That the moral demands placed upon us by deontology are too tough for us. But then the response is those are our ideals. Right? We have to have ideals to strive for. We know we're not going to get there. Right? But if we don't have those ideals, right, and at least say it's logically possible for maybe somebody like Christ to get there, right? Then what we need to do is move in that direction as opposed to the direction of simplicity. All right, so there are two criticisms. We'll have dire consequences, because consequences are not that important on this view. It's doing the right thing that is important. Second criticism is it's just too tough. All right, there are other criticisms as well,
not only too tough emotionally, but so tough that it sometimes leads to what I would consider a wrong decision. I'm very strong against lying, but
yes.
Sometimes to protect somebody's life, it might be right to lie.
What about the Abraham-Isaac story in the Bible, in Genesis?
Yeah.
All right? So there you are. Maybe some of you have children here, right? And you have this absolutely undeniable vision from God, okay, while up here in Holden Village. And God tells you to take your child up to the ark and sacrifice it. What are you going to do?
Better move.
What are you going to do?
Better make it happen.
All right? So the question is, you know, how do we deal with that command? We can't be thinking to ourselves, oh, you know, when I get up there, there will be a deer that I can sacrifice instead. I mean, that's not what was going through Abraham's head if it was a genuine test of faith. Right? So how do we act in that situation? Do we say, well, God, can't do it. You know, I'm not going to do what you tell me I should do. I don't know.
This can't really have been God.
Yeah. You can rationalize. You can rationalize.
Can't trust the dream.
That's where your conscience gets you.
And that is the question. Does it get you into trouble or does it not?
Ask her for another option.
What's plan B, right? What's plan B? All right, okay. Well, I think, should I keep going? Because I can go on for a little bit longer, or we can stop. Yeah.
Will you sometime be able to go into political overtures for what we're talking about here in our present milieu in the USA?
I have done a bit of that. I will do that one more time next week. Actually, two more times next week. One of the things I'm going to do is take a look at our current policies regarding demographic issues. So that will be one application, and then the other application is how someone from a different culture would view what it is that we are doing regarding environmental issues. So I will have practical applications at the end of next week.
Can you touch on Garrett Hardin's lifeboat ethics?
Oh, funny that you should mention that. Directly. I'm going to look at the debate between Garrett Hardin and, do you know who his opponent is?
Mm-hmm.
Peter Singer. Yeah. So we will directly look at the two of them.
What's that about?
That has to do with famine, affluence, and reality. Yeah, famine, affluence, and reality. So what obligations do we have to feed the poor, in part? Yeah.
Saving the population, they reproduce more, eat more, and we're a bigger problem than we started.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Okay, but that's coming up on Thursday, I think. Yes?
Do you remember the story about the guy that fell off a cliff? He was hanging onto a tree on this 1,000-foot cliff. He said, God, please help me. And God says to him, let go. No, he says, is anybody up there? Help me.
Yeah.
And God says to him, let go. And he says, is anybody else up there?
Yeah. You know, maybe just ending on a positive note, or maybe a hopeful note, or at least one that you can think about a little bit further. In many cultures, the idea of God being manifestly present in our lives is closer than it is in our own culture, right? We have viewed God largely in immaterial terms. But if you take a look at Native American culture, if you take a look at culture in India, for example, you will find that their beings are a part of their lives in a very direct way. So your particular example reminds me of a Lakotan Indian who was a shaman. And he was in a very similar situation where he was being chased by something that would eat him inevitably, or he could jump off of a cliff. And he jumped off of the cliff. And Westerners can't figure out how in the world he survived. And he said, I was carried on God's wings. Now, how many times do we think in those ways? Right, where it's not just a spiritual connection that we have, but a physical connection that we have with God, right? And so that's, I think, becoming more and more alien to us. But in other cultures, that's not the case. All right, so that cliff example, I don't know, I think that's where faith and grace comes in as well, but we'll save that for next week too.
Trust.
And trust, absolutely, and trust. You know, when those miracles happen if we allow them to happen. And I'm not sure we always allow them to happen because we want to be in control. Right? That's that whole ego issue that I've talked about before. And sometimes it's a matter of letting go that allows that to happen. But, again, we're jumping ahead.
How did the jury decide in 1842?
Pardon?
How did the jury decide in 1842?
They acquitted.